Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, it is our episode 350. Yes, we made it to 350 episodes of the show. Thank you for listening, thank you for supporting, and thank you for everything and all the feedback you've given us over the years. We're here to preview the July 2022 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember, Retinal Physician can be found online at retinalphysician.com. We cover three articles from this latest issue. We talk about Vuity, the new pilocarpine eye drop approved by the FDA for the treatment of presbyopia and possible effects on the retina. We then dive into a deep discussion of pregnancy and options for treatment with diabetic retinopathy, and end with a discussion of uveitis and negotiating contracts as a retinal subspecialist. As always, remember the articles are online at retinalphysician.com. You can find a list of financial disclosures relevant to this podcast in the episode description, and you can claim CME credits for this podcast and many other podcasts by clicking on the link in the episode description. That will take you to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website to claim those credits. From the Cutter's Mouth is back with the preview of the July 2022 edition of Retinal Physician. As a reminder, Retinal Physician is available for free in print and online at retinalphysician.com. And what we aim to do with these episodes is I'm going to run through a couple of the articles from this issue, and we are going to use them as jumping off points for discussion. If you want to read the whole article, you can, of course, access it for any time on the website. So let's jump right in. Joining me for this podcast in alphabetical order, Shruthi Arapalli, who is in Nashville, Tennessee. Shruthi, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Shruthi is my, you know, in Inception, where like Leonardo DiCaprio has a totem that tells him whether or not he's like in the dream world or he's actually in the real world. I'm going to get back, but Shruthi is my totem for this podcast. I'm going to come back to that thought in a second. The next person on our team is Dr. Safa Rahmani, and she's joining us from Chicago. Safa, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And last but not least, the origin of the totem, Dr. Akshay Thomas, who I will never mess it up because he's in Nashville, Tennessee and not in Memphis, Tennessee. And I may have just booted him from this call. He was so shocked. I think he pressed the hang up button and he's gone.
He's done with us already.
I think Akshay is re-logging back in. But Shruthi, now you're my totem because you are also in Nashville. And so anytime you come on with Akshay, I will remember you're both in Nashville, whereas before it was a 50-50 chance. Akshay, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
Actually, we lost you for a minute, but it was okay. I was monologuing, so it didn't matter. You didn't miss anything important.
All right, thank God.
So let's jump right in. So first article is called Vitreoretinal Views on Vuity. Choose and monitor patients carefully. Suzanne Michalczyk from Stanford, a fellow there, along with Prithvi Mruthyunjaya, faculty at Stanford, and Asan Rahimi, a close friend of mine, friend of the program, also in Palo Alto, put this together. So I'm going to run through this. So they talk a little bit about Vuity. So Vuity is, for those of you who don't know, who are retina specialists, who've had your heads buried in the Regeneron, Genentech, Apellis sandbox. Vuity is this drug that AbbVie and Allergan came out with, which is essentially pilocarpine at 1.25%. It's a diluted pilocarpine. Now it's FDA approved for the treatment of presbyopia. And there's been a lot of advertisement towards patients about it. Many of us have been asked by patients about this. Our anterior segment colleagues and optometrists may be prescribing this drop. And they go through some of the things from the trial. So every drug, remember, has phase three trials for Vuity, Gemini 1 and Gemini 2, no pun intended, the twin trials for this drug. They looked at a pretty substantial number of patients who used Vuity for a month. And they showed that patients had increase in their near visual acuity. And then the biggest thing, they looked at the adverse events, and none of them seemed to be retinal adverse events. However, they then jump into this right up to talking about what are kind of the risks that have been reported in the literature previously with pilocarpine, higher percentages that used to be used for glaucoma. And we all learned this at some point during ophthalmology residency, or hopefully you're learning it if you're a resident now. There is this association with pilocarpine with vitreoretinal surface issues that causes the ciliary body to rotate, maybe that causes the vitreous to move anteriorly, and that can affect the vitreoretinal interface, and maybe pilocarpine is associated with problems. What could those problems be? Vitreomacular traction, retinal breaks, and retinal detachments. Remember, these trials they talk about are underpowered to detect retinal issues, only 750 patients, and they didn't have any fundus exams or OCTs in this trial, which is interesting. But again, it's an anterior segment trial, just like you don't see Schirmer's in, you know, phase three wet AMD trials. I don't necessarily fault them for not putting this in those trials, given that they were looking essentially at presbyopia management. They talk about marketing and how, you know, they spent quite a bit of money on marketing for this commercial, almost $20 million. And then they start talking about there's been some reports of adverse events, including serious adverse events with Vuity in the literature. Nothing that's been published as a series, but there's been this FDA adverse reporting system. I think Suzanne and that whole team are putting together a case series. There was a recent AJO publication that was that showed a couple of cases of bilateral detachment in the setting of Vuity. And they talk about how a lot of the people who are going to be candidates for this drug are going to be people in that age range where they get presbyopia and they don't want to wear reading glasses, 40 to 55. They are probably the patients most prone to getting PVDs. They may not have PVDs, and maybe you promote PVD formation. And as we know, PVDs can be great and in the sense that they don't cause any problems, and PVDs can be bad, or they can cause incomplete PVDs and vitreous macular traction, or they can get tears or detachments. And so they talk about maybe there should be some patient selection that wasn't described in the trials or in the label. Maybe we should be advising our intersegment colleagues, maybe don't use this in patients high risk for tears, myopes, patients with lattice, patients with a history of RD, patient with a family history of RD. We don't really know the answers to it. And then the other question is, should they have a DFE before starting Vuity? Should they have wide field photography? Should they have OCT? And what should you do if they have visual complaints after using it? And they end by saying, you know, the rest committee, SRS has this committee, we can report cases, and we'll see how many cases. This is going to come out this July. We're recording this in advance of July, will be reported. Let's jump right in. So Shruti, first of all, how much have you heard from your anterior segment colleagues about Vuity? How much have you heard from patients? Is this something that you get asked a lot about, or is this something people have run cases by you? What are your general impressions on this drug?
So I'll say in the last couple of weeks, I've had one or two patients bring it up, but I've told them that, you know, I don't typically prescribe it, and I would leave that up to their optometrist or their anterior segment. I have a doctor in our referral network who we exchange a lot of patients back and forth with. So I actually called him before this call to ask what his experience was of prescribing it. And he says that it's definitely becoming more and more popular. He has at least 3 to 4 patients who ask him about it per week. And at this point, he sort of gives them a sample and asks them if they are interested in it to call back. And about 50% of them are interested, and 50% of them don't want it anymore. And maybe he's prescribed about 20 to 30 bottles of it in the last couple of months. He's also a glaucoma specialist, so I thought it was interesting to ask him about narrow angles with pilocarpine, if it's anything that he's worried about. But he said with such a low dosage, that's not something that he really worries about or counts his patients on, but he'd be seeing them anyway before he prescribed the drop. From our standpoint, the two patients that I had, I just did a full dilated eye exam to see if there's any pathology that could potentially worsen with this, like you talked about, retinal attachments or lattice or anything like that, but I haven't personally prescribed it.
Akshay, Shruti actually did homework for this. Are you just writing her coattails? What's been your Vuity experience?
Well, two-part answer. Yes, I am writing her coattails. The second part is I agree with Shruti. I've had a decent number of patients ask me about it. And to be honest with you, the first several I said, I'm not familiar with the studies. I have no idea. I've seen it on television just like you have, and that's about it. And it kind of forced me to actually look at these trials and look at these studies. And to be honest with you, initially, I thought the concentration of the pilo was going to be a lot lower than what we used to use for glaucoma. And I was actually quite surprised that it was as close in concentration to the original pilo. So I kind of said I'm just extrapolating experience and historical data we had with that people with certain risk factors should avoid it. But again, I haven't prescribed it. I've similar to have asked them to talk with their doctors about it. I feel like I've just been on the providing all the precautions to them more than anything.
So Safa, if patients, I know you take care of peds, I'm sure the kids are not asking you, but their parents may be in this age and asking you. Again, have you encountered this? And what do you tell them? Actually kind of touch them. What do you tell patients who are like, oh, should I use this drop? you know, it sounds great and I want to use my reading glasses. What are your thoughts?
I've had actually a few, ironically, a few parents ask and a few of my retina patients. I've steered them away because most of the patients that have asked me have, you know, they're in a retina clinic. They're younger. They usually have some kind of retinal pathology that I'm following them for. And I'll tell them, you know, I'll be blunt. I said, this is a very old medication, reformulated. It was stopped, you know, for a reason. I think glasses are a better option, but, you know, feel free to try and see. But, you know, I give them warning that if you have any new symptoms, anything like that, I'd like to see you. And I think, you know, the trial was really the bare minimum of what you could do to, you know, go through this. You know, they didn't have even a dilated exam. I feel like even just a regular dilated exam would have been helpful just to kind of see what they, you know, what these patients at baseline have. So I personally have sort of steered everybody away, telling them that I don't prescribe it. They're more than happy to try, but my retina patients, they all have pathology. Otherwise they wouldn't be in my clinic. So I've tried to steer them away just because of the possible side effects.
I mean, that's a fantastic point. I know this is not a journal club, but I mean, we have a selection bias here, right? Like we're in all retina specialists. I mean, retina specialists tend, I mean, it's a personality thing. I think we all were less sort of in tune, let's say, to patients' complaints about refractive outcome presbyopia, which is maybe why we opted for retina over an anterior segment field, because that didn't seem as high priority as some of the things we deal with, or it wasn't as exciting or as interesting to us. And those things, I think it's reasonably, if you listen to corneal or anterior segment surgeons or cataract surgeons, I mean, this stuff is important to people, right? I mean, the other thing is none of us are over 40, I think, at this point. And so none of us have, what was that? I didn't hear what you said, but maybe I don't need to know.
I said, I beg to differ.
None of us are well over 40 in this group. See, Safa, I didn't mean to call you out. You didn't have to say anything.
Okay.
You could have just like let it ride and it would have been fine. No one would have Googled you. It would have been okay. Separate aside, I don't understand why you can just Google doctors and find their ages and health grades. I think it's kind of odd as an invasion of privacy, but that's a total aside. Anyway, so like, again, we're not like the target group where we're like, oh, it's hard for us to empathize with that, but I understand why people would be attracted to this option. I mean, there is a market there. You know, I think the fascinating thing is just how it was sort of repackaged, like Akshay was talking about. It's just a totally repackaged drop. And it's like this new thing, but now it's different and we can sell it and we can price it. I haven't heard of really good coverage for it from the patients who have tried to get it. I think the other, you know, what honestly turns patients off the most though, when I talk to them is just when I tell them it's temporary. I don't think the commercials do a very good job of explaining that, which is to the company's benefit. I don't think most patients realize it's temporary. They're like, oh, I'll just put this drop in.
And it'll be cured forever.
Right. And I don't think that it's very clear that you have to keep using it to get that effect. And I don't think a lot of them know, for example, like you shouldn't, I mean, it says on the label, you shouldn't drive like a car, and you shouldn't drive at night or do any operating heavy like machinery because you can't dilate your pupil and it's not safe. But I think it's interesting. And I wonder if we're going to see more of these cases as people use it. I got wind of some of these cases that Asan and his team are putting together. And I think that what we're going to see is that I just told patients away from it just because, again, even I was like the risk benefit, like you said, Safa, just doesn't make a lot of sense. But it makes you wonder what other drops could be repackaged and reformulated for other purposes.
Yeah, I mean, this was direct to consumer commercials. You know, we've talked about these before and how that affects, you know, what patients say and do in a usually negative way.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, it begs the question about like, we talked about this last time, is like, what is kind of the line? It's kind of a blurred line. Like, what's that line at which it isn't okay to do it? And I think most physicians would kind of have the line way over on one side, and most reps or pharmaceuticals have the line somewhere on the other side. And I think the American people, in all honesty, don't have great input into where that line is. I think it just sort of exists and it's pretty nebulous. And a lot of this, I mean, they talked about a lot of this was on this streaming sort of platform, this website. It's really hard to regulate all of the commercials, especially when you have an FDA approved drug. I'm actually surprised the FDA approved this and gave it a label, but I also, I mean, I think part of it is a lot of the people FDA, most, I would give most, almost all of them are not ophthalmologists. So like they don't know. And I don't know why that process works. I guess I want to speak to it, but I don't know how much like they're bringing in people to sort of read through and as experts and decide whether something should be included or not. From there, you know, let's sort of spring in. This next article is about pregnancy and diabetic retinopathy. Rishi Singh, senior author, Kani Kaseth, the first author. And again, they just talk about why DR is affected by pregnancy and why people can develop DR, why it progresses twice as fast. There's many sort of things in terms of hormonal or physiologic pressures that drive this. And they talk about some of the other factors that drive this ahead. They say that the biggest risk is often in the first and second trimester. And they go through actually a lot of the studies that have shown the progression and other risk factors and things that should be considered. Systemic risk factors, you know, high blood pressure, preeclampsia, and then other diabetic issues. It was interesting to me that, you know, in regular, right, quote unquote, regular diabetics, you know, nephropathy has always been shown, okay, nephropathy, retinopathy go together. It does not seem to be the case with pregnant patients who develop diabetic retinopathy or nephropathy. And then, you know, what about other things? CRVOs, it doesn't seem to be anything that's sort of considered. So I think the real crux though, what we can talk about is sort of the recommendations about what you do, right? So when are eye exams recommended? How does that vary depending on the severity of retinopathy? And then they didn't talk about this, just kind of outside the scope of what they did, but management, right? I think is always interesting for us to talk about. And we can probably start there, Shruti, like working back around. I think there's kind of three different management questions, right? So one is follow-up, the second is management of DME, and the third is management of, you know, proliferative diabetic retinopathy and complications. And then that can include vitreous hemorrhage, surgery, et cetera. What's your general rule of thumb, right? So if you see a diabetic patient who needs management, are there ever scenarios you'll consider anti-VEGF? Are you steering clear of anti-VEGF totally? And then if you're not using anti-VEGF, and you have a young phakic patient, what's your threshold for other options? Steroids, focal laser, where do you kind of go from there?
Yeah, I think those are all really important questions. For patients who I'm seeing, I tend to stay away from anti-VEGF if I can, because we have other options that we know are a little bit safer, like steroids or laser. I think even one step before that, we all probably see these young patients who come in with a history of diabetes or type 1 diabetes. They're in this demographic of childbearing age. And I think even before we dive into talking about how to treat them when they're pregnant, trying to get their blood sugar under control before they're pregnant is really instrumental, because we've seen in the literature before that even if we start tightly controlling them while they're pregnant, their retinopathy can follow. And then we're sort of in this sticky place where we don't know how to treat or we can't treat as aggressively or taking the surgery. So that's one really important thing. A couple of the other things you asked about. So for proliferative diabetic retinopathy, I think it's always a safe bet for laser. And I do try to push that in pregnant patients. And I sort of categorize them in the same group as patients who I think are going to be potentially lost to follow-up. And that's not because I think pregnant women are non-compliant, but they've got a lot going on. If they're seeing me for diabetes, they probably have other health conditions as well. So I worry that they're going to be hospitalized, or maybe they're the primary caretaker. They just have so many other burdens to deal with. So if I can do something permanent like laser, I think that's a very good option. Even if they've got severe NPDR, mm-hmm. I think it's reasonable to start talking to them about it. And then for macular edema, focal laser is always an option. Steroids are an option because, again, pregnancy is a finite period of time. So I don't want to be giving someone steroid injections all of the time, but if they're dropping 20/40, 20/50, and they're uncomfortable or have poor vision in their other eye, I think a steroid injection is a very reasonable option at that point as well. And then in terms of following them, if they've got no retinopathy to begin with, every couple of months or so, just to keep an eye on them, 3 to 4. If they've got moderate to severe, I'm probably watching them every month to 2 months to make sure things aren't turning a corner. And then if we have to talk about surgery, there's all sorts of things to talk about there as well, including anesthesia choice. So trying to keep them out of that realm is my main goal.
Safa, you know, we've talked before in the podcast, anti-VEGF in preemies and babies. It's sort of the same conversation, but different. It's interesting because we're okay for the most part as a field using anti-VEGF in ROP, but we're not okay for the most part in our field using it in pregnancy. My question, is there ever a scenario where you would use anti-VEGF in pregnancy? Is there a window there, right? So is there a third trimester patient who's a steroid responder, or is there anybody who's losing vision, right? Or would you just still kind of be like, well, I don't know what the risk of the infant is, so I'm going to hold off?
Yes, I've actually had a couple patients where we've had to have that discussion because their DME was so, you know, got so catastrophically bad, you know, dropped to 2200 vision, 2300 vision. And after discussions, you know, based on, you know, what's out there in literature, that two of my patients chose Lucentis over steroids. And had great response. And, you know, I don't offer them Eylea or Avastin, but Lucentis is, you know, supposed to not cross the blood-brain barrier, supposed to stay in the eye. So at a pinch when we are sort of in the middle of the pregnancy, you've got months to go, they're steering away from steroids. I've found Lucentis to be what I choose. And so far, I've had healthy babies come out of those two examples. Again, very rare, but I do offer that when it's sort of the catastrophic posterior pole disease that is really responsive to anti-VEGF. Lucentis is the only option for them, though. So,
you know, Akshay, Shruti talked about PRP and PRP and PRP, but PRP has been shown by some studies to be inferior on its own to PRP plus anti-VEGF for management of proliferative complications. And now we just talked about this is a condition where the retinopathy is more progressive and more severe and higher risk for complications. If you're going to do PRP, do you always use adjunct steroid? And what do you do to sub out that anti-VEGF effect? Or you just do the PRP and more, do you do it aggressive all at once? Cause you're just like, I need to get it in. Do you just space it out? Like what's kind of your thought process if you did need to do PRP in someone with severe PDR with high-risk complications or high-risk characteristics?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say on average, I for the average patient, I do my PRP over two sessions, and I'd certainly do the same for a pregnant patient. I had one or two scenarios where I had to do PRP on a patient in their third trimester, and there we all know that sometimes our patients can get a prominent vagal response to a number of things we do in the eyes, including laser. And one such patient had a strong vagal response to even a few laser spots. So I think anything we do, I'd say in moderation over a couple sessions is how I tend to do it. If they seem like they're doing great, you know, after one session, they may be a little bit more aggressive, their fellow eye needs treatment. But to start with, I would kind of be measured and do bit by bit. And we don't, I think the goal is not to make their disease completely quiet, you know, necessarily all at that one time, but maybe at least make it a little less aggressive, buy yourself some time, and then do what you need to with either anti-VEGF or additional laser once it's safe to do so.
So I'm gonna bring it back to you for a sec. So let me get into a subject that's a little uncomfortable slash maybe controversial, but it's legit, right? So I had a friend who is a female retinal specialist, and I was talking about this, and they were like, this was when this person was in training and they were still friends. And they were just like, you know, it seems like a bad deal to be a pregnant woman, right? I mean, because you're not getting the standard of care treatment. You're essentially, I mean, I guess you could offer to them, but a lot of times I'm not even offering it. And you're automatically saying, well, you're pregnant, you don't get standard of care treatment, which is anti-VEGF. That is first line in any other scenario, right? There's really no contraindications. You can argue thromboembolic events. And you're not getting it. And you're getting, quote unquote, inferior or potentially worse treatment, right? You know, like Akshay said, you could space out the PRP, but maybe there are higher risks to bleed while the PRP is kicking in, or to contract, or for the disease to kind of blow up, you know, while that PRP, again, is kind of trying to take effect of driving inflammation. You can give them a steroid, but then they get steroid response glaucoma and they get a cataract. And it's like, truth, we didn't even talk about anesthesia, but then your anesthesia options are limited and maybe they don't get minimal anesthesia and then you're getting a block. And, you know, the question, like, how much, like, should we be actually offering people the option and just having them sign off on it, right? Like, I think as physicians, we have to guide them. I mean, most of the time they're looking to us and they're like, what would you do? And it's really hard for me to be like, well, if my wife was pregnant, I would do this. And I've thought about that question, like, what would I do in that scenario? But it was an interesting concept because they were like, this seems like it's obviously very difficult to be pregnant for many reasons besides your retinas. And now we're kind of saying, well, because you're pregnant, you can't get this anesthesia, you can't get anti-VEGF, and yeah, you get to do focal laser like people did back in the 90s, and it may help you and it may not. And if we need to, we can put a steroid in, but you know, then you're like a glaucoma for the rest of your life. Like it kind of sucks in a way. And their question was like, why don't we just have that conversation more often and just have a built-in kind of consent waiver and just like, why as a field has no one done this? Whereas, and that goes back to my question, for preemies, we're okay with it. No one's putting steroids in this, because some people do, but most people are just using anti-VEGF. But then with these women who are pregnant, second, third trimester, we're like, well, we don't want to do it for liability / safety of your baby. Maybe they should have the right to kind of choose what they want to do.
Yes, you've definitely brought out a conversation and a subject that I think can get its own podcast, especially given the recent Supreme Court rulings. I think we should be talking more about the options that the pregnant ladies do. And that is precisely the reason why I give all the options to my pregnant patients, which is why some of them did choose Lucentis, you know, with all the data that we have, with all the options that we have, I think they should get the options, you know, if they choose to. And I understand liability. I understand that we live in a very litigious world and it's only getting worse. But I think a discussion so they know their options and why we're choosing one option as a, you know, recommendation, for them to just know that this is the reason why we're recommended and X, Y, and Z is still on the table, I think it's really helpful for these patients and for openness of discussion of knowing, you know what, in a couple months, this option is going to become more viable. This is what we can do to buy time until you have the baby, you know, and all those, it really allows the new mom to feel like they're being taken care of, you know. And again, I'm because this is a very sensitive subject to me, and I've been, you know, I'm a mother, so I do offer all the options that I think are appropriate. The ones that I think that are not appropriate, I tell them why I don't think that's a good idea, and I move on, and they accept that. So,
Shruti, comments, thoughts?
I think that was perfectly said. I think the more that you're practicing this field, you realize there's certain shortcomings for certain demographics. And again, as Safa eloquently said, offering all the options is the most important thing we can do for our patients.
You know, and our patients actually, you know, a lot of them, they will Google and look up things, you know, they'll come to me with questions and I'll tell them, you know, you've probably read X, Y, and Z, and this is the reason why I think Y is better for you than X. And I'll be very blunt with them, you know, and I take care of kids. So parents come in with a slew of questions, like, why aren't you doing a vitrectomy? Why are you doing a buccal? So I'm prepared to discuss why I don't recommend certain options right off the bat. And I think with pregnant patients, especially the ones that, you know, come in with their research, I'll explain why I think this is X, Y, Z. And I tell them, yes, in 2-3 months, this may be a better option for you, but this is the better recommendation. But if they push, you know, I'll work with them. And again, which is why I don't shy away from Lucentis when it's appropriate.
Actually, to kind of segue this into the next article at UVI, this wasn't covered in your article. What about for your, like, this kind of ties into what you do if you're pregnant uveitis patients, right? So uveitis patients can be very young when you meet them, or they can be in a childbearing age and then they want to get pregnant, or they are getting pregnant, or they come in and say pregnant, or you test them. It limits, I mean, some things you're obviously limited. That is like, no question. It's like, you're not going to put a first trimester pregnant woman on methotrexate, right? But how about the things that again are like category C, right? Is this woman going to be on steroids during their pregnancy? Are they going to be on immunologics? Like, what do you do for patients? Let's say, I'm trying to think of a good example of a condition, like MS has a whole host of its own medications, but I'm trying to think of like uveitis condition. You know, let's say they have, and I'm going to sound really uneducated here, recalcitrant parasplenitis, where, you know, they don't respond, they're bilateral, they don't respond as well to local options, or you've tried local options, you're trying to avoid them for cataract or other issues, and they've been great, doing great on systemic therapy, and now they are pregnant or they want to get pregnant. How do you sort of handle those situations? Like, what's your go-to for the pregnant uveitis patient?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a very complicated one. I'd say that they're, so the first thing is we typically will do it in concert with their MFM or or their OB, there are some medications which, like you said, you absolutely cannot get pregnant on, and you most certainly cannot take during pregnancy, including things like methotrexate. There are some medications like adalimumab, Humira, which most of us will use for the first two trimesters, or other TNF inhibitors, which are thought not to cross that blood-placental barrier. So it might be safe during pregnancy. There are certain antimetabolites like azathioprine, which are, again, purportedly safe during pregnancy. But I'd say the tougher question is that a lot of patients want to get off their medications regardless of what you tell them during pregnancy, because you know they're scared of a perceived risk to baby. And that goes with oral steroids too, you know, risk of cleft lip and palate. And even though it's small, it's a real risk. So oftentimes it's a discussion with them. I tend to tell them that during pregnancy is a relatively immunosuppressive time. And oftentimes we find sometimes our uveitis actually cools down a little bit during pregnancy, just because of that relative immunosuppression that pregnancy causes. So sometimes that's enough for us to give them a medication holiday. But for most people, we're doing a medication holiday. If we need to give them local steroids or a short course of oral steroids, most times OB is fine with that. And if we absolutely cannot get them off their immunosuppressive, we basically go to one which has fairly good safety data. And we have options, just not a lot of them.
Shruthi, again, weighing in on uveitis and pregnancy, anything to add on top of what Akshay said?
No, his response is great. I find that my hand has been forced towards anti-VEGF a little bit more in these uveitic patients because they're just younger. There's more of them, I think, that are younger in the childbearing age. And especially in things like PIC or multifocal-like disease, you get these CNVs that you can treat with steroids sometimes, but once you try that and they're losing vision, that becomes harder because it's so focal and they're noticing their scotoma. Having that conversation, I actually just saw one of these patients today who's trying to conceive, and we're having these conversations about what our therapy should be. But like as Akshay said, using therapies that we know are safe is always the go-to, and then layering on top of that and having a really good discussion.
Yeah, and again, maybe this would be a call to action. Maybe if I'm missing this and I don't read and see everything, then, and I apologize, maybe you guys can correct me. I just feel like as a field in retina and uveitis, for the most part, we're just kind of like, or our opinion as a field, like you go to a meeting and they have 40 minutes of like banter back and forth about it. At the end, everyone's kind of like, well, I wouldn't do it except for like really special situations, right? And I think that puts providers in a really tough spot. Like we talked about, there's an ethical component to it, what you should do. And that should be equal to the legal thing in all aspects, but it's not. I think legally, medical legally, it's really hard for people to feel comfortable doing it when our major organizations aren't coming out with position statements on this saying, hey, we don't recommend you do it, but there are scenarios where you can do it. Like that would be helpful so that legally you weren't worried if you went to court. You could point to a practice pattern from the AAO. You could point to something from ASRS that says, hey, we, as a lead of reading or a team of leading eye doctors or retina specialists are saying, it is okay to use it. And these are the scenarios where we think it's okay. And it's up to the individual provider to weigh risks and benefits and make that decision. And I just don't think we have that. I think that a lot of what we have is kind of like, well, don't do it unless you have to, but really don't do it. And I think it's a little odd because I think we're underestimating what our power as a field could be to just kind of establish that as kind of the norm. And I think that would empower more providers to go ahead and do what's best for the patient rather than do what they don't think is best for the patient, but they're like, well, I don't want to be the one person, the one renegade doing this thing and then get into trouble. But I don't know your thoughts on that, Safa. Maybe you're more hooked into the pediatric community. I just feel there is a little bit of dissonance still between what the pediatric retina community says about anti-VEGF for ROP and what the general retina community says about anti-VEGF in pregnancy.
No, I think you have a great point there. I think the issue is that, I don't think what we're facing is unique to retina per se. I think sort of every field has these outliers, and I haven't seen any societies come out, with these kind of statements. And I think it's because it's very difficult to word exactly what situations would be appropriate. And I wish they would, but I think a lot of even our colleagues in other fields are struggling with that right now.
Right. But my point is we have statements, for example, are like, hey, PVDs don't necessarily need a depressed exam. So don't fault the physician if they don't do it. Like, mm-hmm. it would be really nice, even if it doesn't tell you those situations, if it's like, hey, anti-VEGF is category C in pregnancy. We actually don't know. It's not category whatever F. It's not a fail. It's just there's no data, and there's no data because everyone's scared to do it. And because everyone's scared to do it, we never have data, right? So it'd be nice if it's like, hey, there's no data. You know, if the risks outweigh the benefits, don't do it. But if the provider feels the benefits outweigh the risks, we support, you know, that the provider, you know, does that. I mean, that can be vague enough that I don't think the academy is going to put themselves at liability. I don't want to call it the academy. It could be academy, it could be ASRS, it could be retina, it could be someone who's in an organization to do this. But it's a little curious because it's kind of, as you were referencing, Shruti, it's kind of one of these underserved populations that we don't talk a lot about. And, you know, not many of us have a clinic chock full of pregnant patients. I mean, we're seeing like what, max maybe one or two a day if we're lucky or unlucky to kind of handle these situations. And so it's just an interesting concept. Like why do we talk about it and talk about it and talk about it? But again, I feel like we're doing the same things. Like when I was a fellow 8 years ago, it's like the same conversations about it. It hasn't really moved forward.
I think it's because it's a very difficult topic too.
I know, but then why do I mean, not to get in my high horse, but like, why do organizations exist, right? They should exist to take care of difficult topics. The Supreme Court doesn't exist to tell people that, oh, it's wrong to murder someone else. Although, I mean, I'm sure there's going to be some case. Like you don't need the academy to say, hey, anti-VEGF works for wet AMD. It's like, okay, we all know that. Like, we need organizations to take stances on things that are difficult so that individual providers aren't the ones who are kind of making all these decisions or feel boxed in by what's out there. But I agree. I mean, that obviously it's easier to have inertia and not do anything. Akshay is restraining himself because he's already dropped a curse word on the podcast once, and he's just holding back. So my question is this. So we have this Uveitis Corner article going to end on. We have the editor of Uveitis Corner, which is Shruti. We have Akshay, who is a contributor to this piece. Essentially, this piece, anyone who's interested in a career in uveitis, I would say, or wants to just understand what your uveitis colleagues have to deal with, I think it's an interesting read. It goes through kind of the day-to-day and how to set up a clinic. And it all sounds very, very exhausting for the most part. Akshay, at some point, I think said, he used a lot of words here. He used the word challenging. He used the word challenge like three times. He talked about huge volume. He talked about, what else did he say? It's very different. If you read between the lines, it is tough. It's tough to run a good uveitis practice. And I think Shervin Salek, who's the other guy contributing here, has maybe a Kaiser has didn't have to build it the same way. I think that Akshay maybe had to build it. I just want to focus on one thing before we break. And Safa, you can comment because you're in pediatric retina. So it's the same conversation we've had before. Contracts, right? So we have fellows who are like, oh, I want to do an oncology fellowship or uveitis fellowship or pediatric fellowship. And they're like, every practice is like, oh, we want to hire you right now. Like, how do you actually, I'll start with you. Like, how do you sort of protect yourself in that instance? Like, what's your number one piece of advice for someone who's like, oh, I'm signing a contract to do retina plus this other subspecialty that they really want me to cover for all their patients? Like, what sort of realistic protections can you get so you're not being A, sort of burned out, B, under rewarded, or C, penalized down the line because your RVU gain or your revenue is not the same stream as your partners who are, while you submit 10 prior auths for adalimumab or injecting 100 patients with, you know, the latest anti-VEGF?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question, but I'll kind of go through it bit by bit. So the first thing is regardless of what your subspecialty is, I think a lot of us start thinking that it's going to be a minority of my practice and it's going to take forever to grow. And more often than not, that is not the case. If you're not careful, you can end up going from a retina uveitis specialist to a complete uveitis specialist, and people won't bat an eye, thinking about it. So at the front end, it's really important to decide for yourself what split of patients you want to have in an ideal setting and work towards that. And as you start approaching said threshold, you need to push the group to hire another subspecialist, right? And that's absolutely kind of what we did in our case. In terms of compensation, just like you said, I mean, nothing within our subspecialties within retina will compensate as well as retina, and that's fine. I think some of it depends on your individual practice or university's compensation model, right? Some places you might be splitting all income equally, some places it might be eat what you kill. And it's a different challenge from place to place. You know, I once estimated that I basically had to see about close to two uveitis patients to generate the same non-drug related revenue as one retina patient. So this is you take out all your drug margin, all that stuff, just your billing, right? Because you're not injecting as many of these patients. So you're having to see potentially more complicated patients and more of them to generate the same revenue. So it's just something to kind of think of early on. But most importantly, I'd say when you're talking about a contract, more than any of that, you need the right support team alongside you. It's not just about you going and seeing the patients. You need people that are handling prior authorizations, a good system built in to get your samples out to subspecialty labs, a way to get those labs back to you. You just need a lot of support and infrastructure built around you to run a successful US practice beyond just you and having the patients.
Safa and Pete, similar advice. Anything else you'd add?
Yes, no, absolutely. This resonates with Pete as well, because it's really the support staff and knowing the time that goes into seeing pediatric retina patients versus not. And I also, I think people kind of shy away from having these conversations over and over again. So you can start at, you know, a starting point, you have a contract, you think you've thought of everything. And then a year in, things have changed a little, or the practice has changed a little. And I think you should be open to have those discussions, you know, on a yearly or bi-yearly basis, because things change, resources change. And I think one thing that I notice, you know, we keep talking about that first contract, but we don't talk about 2 years in or 3 years in when you're more established, or you haven't gotten what you were promised, or, you know, now things look different and you have newer needs or different needs. So I think that's a continuous communication that you should have with either academics or private practice that I think will definitely go a long way in maintaining the subspecialty care that you try to provide.
Anything else you want to add, Shruti, on top of what they said? I think you're the most recent to kind of go through this process.
Yeah, and I think I've been so lucky because I've had Akshay's input and mentorship throughout every stage, which is great.
But now he needs to hire another subspecialist.
That's right.
This is like, I've been watching too much Kenobi on Disney Plus. This is like, there always have to be two Sith, right? You can't only have one at a time. Akshay's laughing because he's a Star Wars nerd too. I can tell. He's either Star Wars or Star Trek. I don't know which one.
As a plug to anyone who's listening, working with him would be fabulous. But I think the two things that I also learned or were told in fellowship that were really important was, even if you have a number in mind for how much uveitis or peds or whatever it is that you're willing to see, lowballing it initially might be really helpful, because if you start off at that, you can do it when you're in a really great system with your attendings and you're like, oh, no problem, this will be fine. But once you get on your own, even when you've got someone like Akshay who's built this beautiful system, it's still different. You've still got to figure out what works for you and what you like. So I thought that was very, very important. And being in a practice like this, that sort of started me out slower and then ramped up. And then the other thing, and not to be political or get people irritated, but
we're irritating people all the time here, so go for it. I doubt it's in the top three most irritating things someone will hear on this podcast today. Go ahead.
So one of my attendings actually pulled me aside at the end of fellowship and told me, and I think it's just a phenomenon that happens when you're a woman in VR, but if you then become the woman who does uveitis and VR, being very careful to not become the woman who just does uveitis. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably not articulating the best way possible, but they told me, you know, you're trained, you're a great VR surgeon. Don't let that aspect of you get lost.
Right.
And I think as a woman physician, sometimes, you know, you overextend. I mean, I'm sure male physicians do too, but you accept more patients, you say no problem to the uveitis patients. And so just being very cognizant of the division and that you've done both.
Akshay doesn't overextend. He's just like, you know, Dr. Arapali will take great care of that. I'm just kidding, Akshay. I'm sure he's
wonderful.
I mean, I agree as non-subspecialist, but just someone who's talked to a lot of people and had a bunch of fellows and people reach out. I 110% agree with everything everyone said. I mean, Shruti, I think your point is well taken. And we've talked about this in different forms before. Being a woman retinal surgeon, there's so many different ways you can sort of get pigeonholed. They can say, oh, you know, you don't want to be too busy, you know, and you want to raise a family. So we're going to give you like this lower salary and this like less busy schedule. And that's not right, because that should be your choice, what you want to do. You shouldn't be traveling. It could be the same with medical retina. Oh, we think you're probably going to enjoy doing medical retina more than surgical retina. Oh, we think you're going to uveitis, et cetera. So, but I actually do think it happens to the male uveitis specialist too. I don't know if the degree is the same, but I think I think what you said about under-promising is important, and that's important for a couple of reasons. Like Akshay was saying, you're never going to have a problem filling that 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% subspecialty practice. Everyone is going to want to drive everything into that part of your clinic. The part that you really need to protect is the retina component, because everyone's happy to see the retina patients because they chose to do retina because they like retina. And honestly, at some point, medical retina is pretty easy. You know, it's pretty easy. It's bread and butter. The system's set up for it. You have in a good practice or university, you are set up to do retina well, and you may not be set up to subspecialty well, like Akshay was talking about the infrastructure. And so that would go back to my last point, which is leverage. And again, we all want, I think everyone always talks about, you want to work somewhere where you feel valued and you want to work with people you respect and you like, and that's the number one important thing. But one thing I would say as advice, it doesn't matter how much these people like and respect you. It is the rare person in life and the rare colleague or partner who's going to go out of their way. And I'll say it's 5% or less of people. That's my statistics for the day. 5% of less people are going to actively, as part of their daily routine or weekly or monthly routine, be like, oh, you know, Shruti is really overtaxed. We should send fewer patients that way. Or Akshay, you know, he really is doing an awesome job for the practice. I know his revenue doesn't look as high as, you know, other associate X, but we really should give him that bonus, you know, even though, I mean, I'm not saying that people are bad. I don't think it's malicious, but I think that people just have their own stuff going on. People are busy. People are doing their things. And you can get taken for granted. Back to Safa's point about, it's not only asking for the things you didn't anticipate, it's also sort of reminding periodically that, you know, hey, I'm doing something that no one else here wants to do. And I think, so for leverage, I think it's really hard for fellows right now to feel any sort of leverage with the practice environment and, you know, all the different models that are out there. And I think when you interview, like most places, kind of very few places woo you now. I mean, some places really woo you, but a lot of places make you feel like you're lucky to have the opportunity to interview there. And I think if you're a subspecialist, you got to understand they really, really want you usually. They don't want to see uveitis patients. They don't want to see peds patients. And so the real question is, how much is that worth it to them in terms of things you may want or need? I'm not talking about milking it for money, but it could be, you know, a better base. It could be, you know, a more structured bonus where your bonus is guaranteed, that has less sort of restrictions than a normal productivity bonus. It could be, you know, if you're in a commuting practice or university, that your office mix is a little more convenient for you. It could be ancillary support, but whatever it is, you can ask for it and you can push for it. And if you don't, again, 5% or less of the people you work with are going to volunteer that stuff for you. They're just going to be like, great. You're going to go to all these 7 offices for the university and you're going to see all the uveitis patients everywhere. And we're never going to send you a surgical retinal referral everywhere because we want to fill your patients with uveitis patients. And thanks, goodbye, work for us for the next 30 years and retire. And you're going to be like, well, that's not where I saw my career going. I don't want to spend my life running around. That's how you burn out. I think the number one reason people burn out is you don't actually vocalize what you want. And so you just feel trapped at some point, or people don't listen to you. That's also bad. But you feel trapped. And I think for many of us, instead of just telling people what's bothering us, we'd rather just walk away and find something else. But that's my little soliloquy about protecting yourself. But I think you really need to. No, but I think you need to. I mean, I'm not a complainer and I'm not a squeaky wheel. I know people talk about squeaky wheels getting the grease. I'm not even talking about that. I'm just talking about we've talked about this so many times before. Safa, I think you were on a podcast. We talked about this. If you negotiate well at the beginning, it's not about hurting feelings. I think we're always conditioned to want to please people, but it's about like set the expectations and be properly valued, because unconsciously, if you're paid less than other people, you're going to be valued less. And unconsciously, if you are doing work that no one else wants to do, but they don't realize it, it's out of sight, out of mind, then you're not going to be valued. And if you're not valued, you're not going to end up happy. And it's not good for you or the practice, the university long-term, if you're not happy, because you're not going to stay. I don't know if anyone has additional comments. Go ahead.
No, I agree. Great point.
I mean, I completely agree with what Sava said. One thing I'd say to new graduates is that, you know, when you're not exactly sure what your practice is going to look like, how successful your practice is going to be, sometimes you feel a little awkward asking for everything up front, right? You're like, I need these many uveitis coordinators. I need this imaging. I need this. I need that. And sometimes it's good to, like Sava said, like come back to it, you know, like 6 months out and ask for things bit by bit. The other thing I'd say is that a lot of times when all these patients are filling your clinic, your partners really have no idea what you're doing, what you're seeing, and what a day in your clinic is like, right? It's not like in fellowship, or at least you have fellows that kind of understand the difference between one clinic and another. And so you can kind of suffer very quietly, or you can make it known exactly what is going on in your clinic and what you need. And I think you definitely should continuously do that. Because if people are unwilling to support you for you to have a successful and practice where you're not going home and just, you know, shedding tears or being completely burned out, maybe it's not the right place for you.
Very powerful words to end a podcast on, Akshay. Much, much better than the time you cursed on this podcast. This was uplifting. This was like a great end of a early 90s sitcom episode. I could hear the Full House music playing in the background. All seriousness, amazing advice. I hope fellows, residents are listening. I hope the people out there feel empowered. And thank you guys for taking the time. Three difficult topics that we covered. We went way over time, which is always my MO, so I'm sorry. And thank you, Shruti, Safa, and Akshay for joining.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jay.
Many thanks to Doctors Arpali, Thomas, and Romani for joining me for this episode. Listeners, remember, you can find all of our episodes, all 350, on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. They're all there, archived and easily searchable. You'll also find all of them in the podcast store on your favorite app, whether it's Apple or Android. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and you can reach us by reaching out to us on social media or by emailing us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. There's also the contact us link on our website, and you can subscribe on the website to receive email updates as episodes release. Thanks again to our whole production team. That includes Dr. Justin Ma, Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Mike Benincasa, and Dr. Angela Chang. Listeners, thank you for listening for these 350 episodes. Thank you for all you do. Thank you for the patients you take care of on a daily basis. And thank you for the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
The feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.